Hi, it's Diane. On my mind.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Lester Holt, and welcome to the first Democratic debate.
20 Democrats seeking their party's presidential nomination took to the debate stage this week. Over two nights, we heard from the crowded field on health care and immigration.
Watching that image of Oscar and his daughter Valeria is heartbreaking. It should also piss us all off.
As well as gun control and how to make the economy work for all Americans.
It's doing great for giant drug companies. It's just not doing great for people who are trying to get a prescription filled.
The Washington Post's James Homan joins me in the studio to talk about who stood out, the state of the race, and what we learned about the future of the Democratic Party. James, it's good to see you.
Great to see you.
Give me your sense of the importance of these two nights of debate to the entire electoral process.
You never want to put too much stock in one debate, but I think the effect that it has is it's the beginning of a new phase of the election. For 6 months now, these candidates have been traveling around Iowa. They've been going to what we call cattle calls, you know, where they all kind of speak in these forums. And the rules of the Democratic Party mean that they actually have not been able to really clash directly. And so this was the first time we saw how they stand head to head. There were 20 people on stage. There are going to be fewer people in the next debate and fewer still after that.
How is that going to be decided?
After the debates we just had, the Democratic National Committee has announced new, more stringent requirements for polling. So you have to poll a little stronger. And also you have to raise more money from more donors. I think this time you had to have raised money from 65,000 different individual donors. Next time it's 120,000. And so, you know, some people won't be able to do that.
Who's likely not to be on stage?
It's funny because, you know, some of the people who had an easier time qualifying for the first debates were the people who have never run for political office before. Andrew Yang, this tech entrepreneur who kind of has tapped into this internet community, not even necessarily progressives or liberals, but lots of libertarians. And so, you know, is he going to be able to continue to raise money? Marianne Williamson, a spiritual guru, self-help author. You know, she was on the debate stage. But then you had Steve Bullock, the two-term governor of Montana. He got elected as a pretty progressive Democrat in Montana on the same day Donald Trump won the state by 25 points. So he has something to say, you know, whether he's the nominee or not. He's someone I think most people agree ought to be on stage because he has points to make. He didn't qualify for this first debate. And so he's working really hard to qualify for the second one. His people think that they've already sort of gotten there. So I think you might see Bullock and then Seth Moulton, a congressman from Massachusetts, both make it on stage in the next debate, but then not have some of the others. And I also think what will happen is, you know, I think the consensus now is that Beto O'Rourke had a really bad first debate. And so the question is, like, what impact does that have on his fundraising? Does the money sort of dry up for him? And do people kind of get less excited? Again, these can be very clarifying, but the Democratic convention is still not going to take place in Milwaukee, Wisconsin for more than a year.
Exactly.
We're 13 months away. And I think we'll look back, regardless of what ends up happening, and kind of laugh at some of the people we were taking seriously and some of the people we weren't taking seriously. A lot will change between now and then. And when you kind of look back at, you know, the big moment in the first Republican debate of 2011 was Tim Pawlenty and Mitt Romney. And, you know, there were seven different people at the top of the polls at some point in 2011 before Romney became the Republican nominee. I think you could have something similar happen this time. And the big question, of course, is what happens to Joe Biden? Is he able to maintain his frontrunner status?
And in 2015, at about this same point in the debating process, didn't you have Donald Trump at 1%?
Yeah. I'm one of the people who wrote a piece about this point in 2015 saying Donald Trump will not be the Republican nominee for president. You can take it to the bank. And so after 2015, 2016, I'm out of the predictions game.
Yeah.
And I'm a baseball fan. Yogi Berra had a quote. He said, I try not to make predictions, especially about the future.
Exactly.
So I'm just soaking it in. One of the things we're being careful about at the Washington Post this year is not to declare a front runner. So we're not in our stories.
Good.
You know, it's Joe Biden. He's the former vice president. He's well known. But we're not describing him as the front runner. We say Biden is leading in the polls, but we don't call him the front runner because it really does feel like a fluid race, and also the voters ought to decide.
Tell me how you think Joe Biden did last night.
I think he struggled. He did pretty well in the 2007, 2008 Democratic debates. And in that situation, he wasn't the front runner. He was sort of the guy on the wings of the stage who scored some points against both Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. And I mean, obviously he debated well against Sarah Palin in 2008 and sort of had a kind of a goofy strategy against Paul Ryan in 2012, but it worked when he was the vice president. But this is the first time in a primary debate where he's the front runner or whatever, he's leading in the polls. And so he is not accustomed to getting attacked from the left. He's just not used to having to be criticized from the left. Kamala Harris, the headline, of course, was criticizing him for busing and for integration, but she also criticized the Obama-Biden administration, as she called it, for deportations, for deporting millions of people. She noted that when she was Attorney General of California, she resisted some of the immigration efforts that the Obama administration was doing, that you could see that kind of coming from a mile away. But Biden wasn't prepared, it didn't seem like, to defend that. He wasn't prepared to defend his vote for the Iraq war, even though you kind of know that's going to come up. And so I think it's hard. And it showed that he's now been out of office for 3 years. And I think he's been very accustomed to traveling around the country, promoting his book. And he's sort of been this elder statesman of the Democratic Party. So he's used to a lot of people being very friendly to him, being very respectful, being, you know, civil, to use his words. And all of a sudden he's on stage and there are 9 people who want to defeat him.
Exactly.
And they all wanted to score points. They all wanted attention. And I was a little surprised by how many of them decided the way to do that, especially after the debate on Wednesday, was to go directly after Biden. It wasn't just Senator Harris. Eric Swalwell, he's like 35 years old. He's from the East Bay of California, San Francisco area. And he noted early on in the debate that when he was 6 years old, he went to the California Democratic Party convention in San Francisco and watched Biden deliver a speech in which he called for passing the torch. And he said, let's pass the torch. It's been 30 years. And so, you know, he kind of went all in. You know, that was his calculation, which wasn't wrong, was that attacking Joe Biden would get him attention and would keep him in the conversation. You know, the Biden campaign's not over by any stretch. He can totally recover from this. This isn't, but it does sort of increase the stakes for the next debate because, you know, his big pitch has been that he is the guy who can go toe to toe with Donald Trump. And that's, so many Democrats want someone who can beat Trump. And they want someone who can debate Trump. And so I think last night it looked like maybe he doesn't pack the fastball that he used to. And it looked like Kamala Harris maybe could go toe-to-toe with Donald Trump. And so Biden's challenge now after last night, after the first debate, is to show anyone who might be skeptical that he can still pack that punch.
So interesting that Trump's name came up almost not at all in the first debate. And yet last night, there he was.
Yeah, I was surprised by that too. And it's telling because during the first months of the campaign, there was a very strategic decision made by a lot of these presidential campaigns in January and February to introduce themselves on their own terms. So when Elizabeth Warren announced her presidential campaign in January, she went out of her way to avoid saying Donald Trump's name because the thinking was, if this is about Trump, we're going to lose. I have to put my best foot forward. I should talk about myself and my plans. And then when Biden actually announced his campaign, he put out this video that got good reviews that highlighted the president's mishandling of the Charlottesville episode when he said there were some very fine people on both sides. And Biden really frontally went at Trump, said, I'm a fighter. I'm going to take the fight to Donald Trump. And he got traction for that. People liked that. The base liked that. And so then you saw a shift where a lot of the candidates really have been willing to more directly contrast themselves with Trump. Trump's obviously very unpopular with Democratic primary voters, so it has been sort of surprising that they weren't for a while. But I think similar calculations were underway on Wednesday, and I think the candidates on Thursday saw a real opportunity. frankly, for any of the 20 people who were on stage Wednesday and Thursday night, if Donald Trump attacks them on Twitter, that is like the best political donation, in-kind contribution that they could possibly get. Amy Klobuchar, the senator from Minnesota, when she announced in February, she gave her announcement speech in a blizzard in Minneapolis, and Trump made fun of her on Twitter. And he said, you know, she's like a snow white, snow angel. He had some kind of pretty anodyne, stupid tweet. And Amy Klobuchar still going out to lunch on that. She still talks about it in her stump speech. You know, Donald Trump's afraid of me. He's attacking me on Twitter because he knows that I could beat him. So all the candidates sort of want to get on Trump's radar. And the best way to get on Trump's radar is to attack him directly.
Exactly.
So I think sometimes they're trying to bait him into responding.
So what about the difference between so-called liberals and progressives? To what extent did that really show up in the first debate and the second debate?
We thought that the second debate was going to be Bernie Sanders versus Joe Biden and sort of a, you know, a contrast between sort of socialism, democratic socialism, and a more moderate view. And that wasn't the debate that played out. And in fact, that almost wasn't a factor at all, despite the moderators were trying. John Hickenlooper, the former governor of Colorado, he's been going around intentionally getting himself booed at liberal events by saying socialism is not the answer. So he did that at a California Democratic function. He kind of said, if we're identified with socialism, we're going to lose to Donald Trump. And you had Michael Bennett, the senator, current senator from Colorado, who also was making a similar point, but that was totally overshadowed by race. You know, in the Thursday debate, race was really the fault line, and kind of those shifting tectonic plates of race caused an earthquake in Miami. And those were the rawest moments. It wasn't just Harris versus Biden. It was Pete Buttigieg, the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, was pressed for, you know, 25% of his city that he's the mayor of is African-American, only 6% of the police force is. He was asked why that is, and he said that was his failing. He took accountability, took ownership for it. Bernie Sanders was pressed by Chuck Todd, the NBC Meet the Press host, on, you know, why he made a comment the day he announced where he was asked about all these diverse candidates. And he said, you shouldn't pay attention to a candidate's gender or race or sexual orientation. What you need to pay attention to is their ideas. And I have the best ideas. And so Sanders was sort of pressed on that and was kind of on the defensive to explain why he thought diversity is good, but not the be all end all. And so that was what the Thursday debate was about. In some ways, the Wednesday debate was more about ideology. There were sort of four flashpoints in the Wednesday debate that to me captured the tension inside the Democratic Party over what how far left the Democratic Party has moved since Barack Obama left office. The main one was Medicare for All.
Sure.
At the very start of that debate on Wednesday night, the moderator, Lester Holt, asked, would you support abolishing private health insurance to have a government-run healthcare system?
Yeah.
And Elizabeth Warren went all in. And she'd been wishy-washy on the campaign trail. She'd been, and Bernie Sanders was actually, Sanders' campaign officials tell me, was prepared to attack her for being wishy-washy in the Thursday debate and saying, I'm clear on where I stand. Warren wasn't. So Warren, preempting that attack, raised her hand, said, I'm all in on this. And so did Bill de Blasio, the mayor of New York. And that created an interesting debate because you actually have you had two more people raise their hand when they were asked the same question on Thursday night.
Kamala Harris then said she had made a mistake.
She did, and she walked it back. Because the reality is a lot of people like the idea of Medicare for All, and a lot of people like the idea of a public option of sort of Medicare for those who want it. But they don't – you know, there's a lot of people who maybe hate their having to deal with the insurance companies, but they sort of like the idea that they have insurance and they don't want to lose it. And so – that was a tension point in the Wednesday debate. The other big tension point was whether to decriminalize undocumented immigrants.
Right.
And there was a tension point there. Julian Castro really ripped into Beto O'Rourke for saying that he doesn't think it shouldn't be a criminal offense to cross the border in an unauthorized way. And you know, so there were ideological tension points. I think the Wednesday debate was about ideology and the Thursday debate was about identity.
Now, tell me about Bernie Sanders, because he sort of right out of the box put his plan right there in front of everybody. Is he still riding as high as he was earlier?
He is not, but he still is riding high. He has a very devoted base of support. He still draws large crowds, especially in New Hampshire. I actually think today you'd have to call him the leader. He's the candidate to beat in New Hampshire. Again, 10 months, 8 months, long time until anyone votes, things could change. But he has been losing support. And he's been losing support because people want a fresh face. They want someone new. They want an outsider. Bernie Sanders, I think, has a very legitimate claim to outsider status. No one can ever call Bernie Sanders an insider, but he's a known commodity at this point. He's also struggled to make inroads with minority communities. His big challenge in 2016 against Hillary Clinton was that he just couldn't really break through with the African American community, which is 60% of the Democratic primary voters in South Carolina. And so he hasn't really successfully broken through with minorities. And I think there's a lot of people who don't think he can beat Donald Trump and who maybe still really like him and even like his ideas, but they're intrigued by Kamala Harris or Elizabeth Warren or Pete Buttigieg or, some of the others, Tulsi Gabbard even. I think, he's not a credible, serious contender, but she is sort of the unabashed anti-war candidate in this campaign. And she's really built her campaign around opposition to going to war with Iran. And a lot of Bernie's supporters in 2016 were anti-war kind of folks. And so I think, even if that's 2% of his support, that's going to her, I think some of the Sanders support is splitting. The Sanders point of view, the campaign point of view, is that he has a high floor of support, that there's sort of a built-in 15% of Democrats who are going to be with him no matter what, the same way Ron Paul did in 2012 when he ran for the Republican nomination. But there is a fear among the Sanders campaign that he has a pretty low ceiling of support, but they think that maybe he's not going to get 50% of Democratic votes. But if the field is so fragmented, he can do what Donald Trump did in 2016, which is, the majority of Republicans through the Republican convention in Cleveland thought Donald Trump was a clown.
I know.
And now it's kind of hard to believe.
Yeah.
But if there was ever truly a head-to-head race in that Republican contest in 2016, Trump would have probably lost. But instead, he always benefited from sort of being at 35, 40, 45%. And then you had John Kasich and Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz dividing up the vote. And Trump just kept accumulating delegates.
Now a quick break. When we come back, more with James Homan, national political correspondent for The Washington Post and author of The Daily 202.
DC's Daily.
DC's Daily.
DC's Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DC's Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Now, the rest of my conversation with James Homan. In terms of telling us about each candidate, do you think that the format helped Americans as much as perhaps those of us inside Washington? I mean, I found myself thinking, two or three questions here, two or three questions here, and then fireworks. And how much does this format help us?
It's a really, really good question. I'm covering it as a journalist, trying to kind of write a story about it. And I think the media does focus on the conflict narrative. Where's the tension? And that's not just being sensational. That's sort of looking at where are the dividing lines inside the Democratic Party? What is the choice being presented to voters? So it's a really good question because I think, one of the things I talked to all these candidates, strategists, and advisors going into the debate, and they were saying, look, for many people, this is going to be the first time they've seen us at all. And so, on the one hand, if you want to get kind of on cable TV afterward. You have to criticize someone and have a fight. On the other hand, you know, if you're Amy Klobuchar from Minnesota, you feel like you have a good story to tell. People don't really know you. They've never even seen you speak. And so maybe just put your best foot forward, introduce yourself a little bit. On the other hand, like there is something to be said for a presidential campaign is a test of your ideas. You have to be challenged. And one of the things the candidates and the campaigns hate are the yes or no questions. You know, campaigns hate being put on the spot because politicians like to equivocate. They like to give themselves outs and have nuance. And there's a lot of people who don't like this, even in the media. I like saying, would you decriminalize, you know, people coming across the border? Would you get rid of private insurance? Yes or no? It's a yes or no question. Like, raise your hand. In 2011, during one of the Republican debates, famously, the candidates were asked, would you pledge not to raise taxes? If you could have a deal where you could get $10 in spending cuts for every $1 in tax increases, would any of you take that deal? And no one raised their hand. And later people said they regretted that because it's a pretty good deal, actually, if you're conservative.
But
some people see those as gotcha questions. I actually think they're kind of a value, especially if you follow up. One of the things I didn't like about the debate was how it felt like the moderators just kept talking about how they were running short on time. I think there were several moments where the moderators cut off what could have been a really, for voters, revealing exchange. And even last night, I think they could have let Biden and Harris not duke it out for duking it out's sake for good television, but have the debate go back and forth and you know, let other people jump in. And so I think that it was kind of the your 30 seconds are done, we need to move on, and just kind of cutting off the conversation denied voters an organic debate.
Yes,
and made
exactly.
It made it feel like you're, you know, appearing on a cable news show,
exactly,
less than having a real great debate about the big issues facing our country.
I found myself wondering whether it wouldn't have been better to have 4 1-hour debates with 5 people on the stage each time, which could have given the voters a sense of really more of who these people are. I don't know. I have not found that these early debates are terribly helpful. But this format, especially with 10 people on the stage, I don't know. Maybe I'm just old-fashioned.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. You know, one of the things is there's a lot of things we still don't know about the candidates. One of the challenges, I cover these folks full time, and it's hard to pin them down
right on
some of the specifics. So, for example, we don't know what Joe Biden's current position is on the death penalty. The New York Times did this interesting feature where they got 21 of the candidates to come in and answer the same long set of questions. And so they asked everyone about the death penalty. Everyone said they're against it, except Steve Bullock from Montana. Biden historically has been very pro death penalty, but he sort of has hinted that he's changed his position. The other one, so when you ask the campaign spokespeople in the spin room, what's Joe Biden's position on trade? They're very unclear. They won't be pinned down. Biden's spokespeople won't answer whether Biden supports the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which he helped sell when it was being pushed by the Obama administration, but is unpopular with a lot of liberals and especially labor unions who he needs to appeal to. One of the things about a debate is it can kind of put people on the record in a way that, you know, it's hard sometimes, even when you get access to these candidates, to really get them on the record on things. On the other hand, I think the format that we're talking about, the reasons you and I agree that the shortcomings of this format is, you know, like Elizabeth Warren was actually able to duck kind of taking specific positions on several issues that came up.
Such as,
you know, it was a gun licensing system or even gun confiscation. She said, I'll have to study that. We should do research on that. I support a federal effort to look into it, you know, and that. It's a dodge, you know, and she did that a couple times where she said, let's look into that. Let's have a conversation, which whenever a politician says, let's have a conversation, that's being noncommittal. It's not actually engaging with the question.
So both nights, how much did those debates reflect a swing to the left? And is that where Democratic voters are?
That's the great question. a lot of Democratic voters are not checked in yet. You know, a lot of people trying to just live their lives aren't tuning into MSNBC and watching 4 hours of debates on a Wednesday and a Thursday night when it's basically the summer, you know, and beautiful out. And so someone like John Hickenlooper, who I mentioned is getting booed for saying socialism is not the answer, Hickenlooper's calculation, he's basically gambling his campaign on the idea that the activists who show up at these events a year before people vote aren't reflective of the people who are actually going to be voting. And on the other hand, if you're a presidential candidate, the energy for sure is on the left. So it was moderates who won control of the House. We spent all our time talking about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
Precisely.
But the Democrats won control of Congress because they flipped House seats in the suburbs of Dallas, you know, that maybe voted for Donald Trump in many cases. And so those people are very important, and they do have a constituency. Joe Biden has been trying to appeal to them. But he also, you know, he flip-flopped on the Hyde Amendment because he concluded that you can't alienate the left. You can't – the progressive base of the party can't hate you because if they do, they are energized. They're volunteers, you know. And so a lot of the – kind of the lower propensity voters who are Democrats but aren't – you know, they aren't talking about it all the time and they're not watching Rachel Maddow.
Yeah.
They don't volunteer as much. They're not going online to give campaign contributions, especially right now. And so because they're trying to appeal to those people, you know, that's – I think – Elizabeth Warren is very savvy. She's more practical than people give her credit for. And she has concluded on Medicare for All, for example, that while she knows it's a big risk in a general election, that Donald Trump would have a field day saying she's going to take away your insurance. But her calculation is, I've got to win the Democratic nomination first. And so that's why you have this race to the left. And even Bernie Sanders is going to the left, which I think says something about their calculation. The free college tuition debt forgiveness plan that Sanders unveiled this week is actually significantly more liberal and expansive and expensive than what he was proposing when he ran against Hillary Clinton in 2016.
So David Brooks, writing this morning, said Democrats don't leave the moderates behind.
Yeah.
So he's worried, too, that it's going to go so far left that those people, those voters who are thoughtful, moderate voters are not going to be able to go that far left. But would those moderate voters vote for Trump again?
They might stay home. They might stay home.
That's a fear.
Part of it is, you know, it's hard to know exactly what the percentage is, but something like 7% of the electorate voted for Barack Obama twice and voted for Donald Trump. Now, a lot of people who are listening are going to be like, how could you vote for Obama and Trump? But you know, that's like a tenth of the country. And so if you're a Democrat, you can't demonize those people. You know, no one wants to be told like anyone who voted for Trump is an idiot or what, you know, and then be like, but vote for me, come to my party. So I actually – last week I was in South Carolina and there was a conference that was sponsored by the center-left think tank Third Way. And there's sort of, you know, a lot of moderate Democrats. And they brought in a lot of the state party chairs from the blue wall states that got breached by Trump. So the state party chairs of Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania. And there was a real – there were about 200 party leaders. And I was surprised by how, even though it seems like Bernie Sanders has faded a little bit for the reasons we've talked about, they think that even just the idea that Bernie Sanders could win the Democratic nomination is an existential threat. And they worry that it could, you know, that it would really hurt them in these states. Heidi Heitkamp, who was a moderate Democratic senator from North Dakota who lost re-election in November, she was at this kind of – it wasn't really a conference. It was really a gathering to talk about stopping Bernie Sanders that I was covering. And she talked about how, you know, Democrats are just getting wiped out in rural areas. And she said, you're never going to – Democrats aren't going to win rural areas. But if they're getting 20% of the vote instead of 35% of the vote, you can't win the election. And so she was talking about, you know, how Democrats need to have a better answer on immigration and on some of these things. And so I think that there are a lot of people like Heidi Heitkamp who watch the debates. Claire McCaskill would be another example, who lost in Missouri last November, who would say this, you can blow it. You know, just because Donald Trump's approval rating is in the low 40s doesn't – it's historically hard to beat an incumbent president.
Right.
You have the advantages of the White House in the Rose Garden and being able to fly around on Air Force One, and we actually have a historically strong economy at the top line at least. But it's a great question. I think you could have a lot of moderates who – you know, if Bernie Sanders is the nominee, would say like – I'm not going to vote for Donald Trump or Bernie Sanders.
Interesting.
Like, I'm just not going to vote.
Well, James, you've been absolutely wonderful. Thank you for clarifying so much for us.
It's a real honor to be with you.
And that's all for today. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Look for past podcasts and even old Diane Rehm shows at dianerehm.org. Our theme music is by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsverk of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineer this week is Natalie Urev-Livger. Thanks for listening, everybody. I'm Diane Rehm.